This is Andrea Chase, and I'm talking with Joe Wright and James McAvoy about Atonement, based on the Booker Prize-winning novel by Ian McEwan. The hottest day of summer sets into motion a series of events that, by chance and misunderstanding, separate new lovers and leave a young woman with a lifetime of guilt to carry for a rash choice that can never be undone. Film co-stars Keira Knightley, Roma Lagari, and Vanessa Redgrave. Wright most recently directed Pride and Prejudice, for which he won the BAFTA Award for Best Newcomer. McAvoy has played a quadriplegic in Rory O'Shea Was Here, sported goat legs in The Chronicles of Narnia, and was terrorized in Uganda by Idi Amin in The Last King of Scotland. And just parenthetically, this must have been something of a relief for you, just from a physical standpoint, just diving into water and wandering around battlefields.
Yes, it was a bit of a relief. But again, I like doing the kind of physical side of things, and you always, even when it's subtle, you still get to think about the physical things, and they're subtle to everybody else. Nobody else knows them, but you think you're doing loads of things, you know. So yeah, I loved it, and I think this character still gave me a lot of opportunity to try and portray it physically, you know.
There's one particular scene. Well, there are many particular scenes, but there's one beautiful scene where you leap over a garden gate in full evening dress, and it looks so effortless and so beautiful.
That was the fifth take, and the other four takes weren't quite as effortless. But
we
yeah.
Were all really impressed when you did that, though.
Thanks.
You did it. Yeah, we were.
Thanks, man.
Yeah. That's when the rumour started that actually you'd been a ballerina.
Prior to
becoming an actor.
I worked at the Scottish National Ballet, the Royal Scottish Ballet.
Did you?
Yeah. And there's a part in their Christmas show, Cinderella, where they needed basically these bad ballet dancers come in and entertain the King and the Queen. So instead of hiring ballet dancers, they hired actors who couldn't dance to come in and do the ballet dancing really badly.
I'm learning something here. I never knew that.
Yeah. It's deep.
Did you wear tights?
I wore tights and a little mouse's mask.
I love
a niece's mask.
Right,
yeah.
Nice.
It was nice.
Did that come in handy later when you had to stand on tippy toes for Narnia?
It did, yes.
You are one of the few men I know that could probably wear high heels without difficulty?
Yeah, I'd say so, but only if they're spring-mounted.
Getting back to Atonement, I want to talk a little about adapting a book to the screen and the way you have to take it apart and put it back together again. The pleasures and perils of visualizing a novel that comes from the page and creating a character that exists on the page.
There's this kind of received wisdom that adapters, writers often use when they say, obviously, there comes a point when you need to throw the book away. And I kind of always had kind of nodded my head wisely. And on this, we kind of questioned that and really decided to be as faithful to the novel as possible and simply to try and find cinematic equivalents to McEwan's extraordinary prose. So it was a fairly simple process, in a way, adapting it. We started on page one and we went, asked ourselves, how do we show this on film?
And you, Jamie, you're reading on the page and the character is described as having optimism in his eyes.
It's difficult when you're portraying somebody that's in a book. Sometimes you can feel a bit locked and a bit like you don't have many options. And sometimes it's completely liberating. This time it was completely liberating, strangely. I think because I believed in the character so much and I loved the character so much, I didn't want to change him. I tried to change him for the first week of rehearsals, I think, and I couldn't really do the part properly until I think Joe convinced me to just leave him alone, you know. And then I fell in love with him a bit more. Conversely, I suppose, with the other film you mentioned, Last King of Scotland, it really wasn't useful to use the book in any way because the character's so, so different. So it depends, really. If you're making a faithful adaptation, the book is invaluable. And if you're not making a faithful adaptation, sometimes, I think, for an actor anyway, it helps to sometimes go, right, okay, we're on a completely different thing here. And the book actually totally got in the way with Last King of Scotland, you know.
Part of the plot turns on the use of a word I can't use on radio. We can call it the C word and get away with that. And I was just curious, because of the peculiar rules of censorship and rating in this country, I don't know if it's the same in England, in order to use that word, did you have to make a trade-off? You could only use it so many times, or you can use that word, but you can't use swear words elsewhere?
No, not really. I mean, I was fairly uncompromising in the use of the word. It's an Exocet missile of a word, and it's used very carefully and very specifically. There was a hilarious meeting at at Universal Studios just before they greenlit the movie, at which, you know, I was asked whether I couldn't possibly use a different word, and I said, well, what word do you suggest? And the executive said, well, what about the V word? And I said, what vagina. This seemed completely wrong to me. So I put my foot down and I said, we're very, very excited to make this film, but only on one condition, and that's that the stays in the picture. And that was the end of it. It's a word that's actually never spoken in the film. It's a word that's only written down.
And it's used as a beautifully descriptive word. It's not used as an aggressive, demeaning word in any way. He uses it as a celebration. He's completely in love with her C-word.
Exactly. It's the context. But there's something about seeing it in letters that are 20 or 30 feet high.
I know. I was so excited when I came up with the idea of doing that moment and typing those letters on the screen and imagining them 50 foot high, accompanied by the hammerhead of the typewriter sound. I love things like that. It thrilled me.
There are so few words anymore that can actually bring an audible gasp. Yeah. From an audience.
Kind of the only one, isn't it, really?
It's a strange one as well, because it's one that, you know, I'm not saying that I'll gladly go around calling kids it or anything like that, but at home, me and my friends will call each other it sometimes. Me and my wife will call each other it sometimes, jokingly, do you know what I mean? But again, watching it in a film, you do still go, ooh.
It's also a word that's used a lot more freely in Britain than it is here in the States, I believe. But Shakespeare used it, you know? I mean, it's a word, it's a very, very old English word. It's got a long and beautiful history.
Yes.
Well, if we didn't need the word, we wouldn't have the word, well, obviously.
Exactly.
That's
exactly
why. And I also want to ask, there's this amazing sequence in the film on the beach in northern France as a bunch of troops are waiting to cross the channel after the Battle of Dunkirk, retreating before the Germans. And because I work in radio, I was very interested in the way you designed the sound for that sequence, because I think sound can be almost more evocative than any image you can put on the screen.
I agree. You know, audiences these days, all of us, are so cine literate and we're so image literate. We've been taught by assimilation, by kind of osmosis, to understand images, and sound is somehow working on a different level. It creeps up behind us and it and we're not often aware of what it's doing to us. So I think sound is 50% of film is sound for me, and it was a film that I could really start to play with sound. I used to, when I was doing TV, I used to always get very, very frustrated by the lack of dynamic range one was able to use, because all the sound was coming out of a little speaker on your TV set. And so when I graduated to film, one of the things I was most excited about was using the full dynamic range of cinema sound systems and really playing with those. I think the film is definitely a theatre experience. I would therefore urge people to see it on the big screen rather than watching on TV. It's been made for that experience.
What were you actually hearing? Because before the Foley goes on and all the sound is laid in on the track, as you're wandering around that beach, what are you actually hearing at the time?
You're hearing the sounds of 1,000 people and you know, you're hearing the odd bit of crew banter and murmur and communication going on, but you were hearing the real sounds of 1,000 supporting artists who gave everything, heart and soul, into evoking one of those moments on a beach in Dunkirk, and that was incredible. I've often said that it's very rare that you get to look 360 degrees when you're acting and not have to imagine. But I hadn't thought about the sound aspect, but that the sounds that were coming were, I couldn't define 99% of them, because it was such a cacophony of improvisation, you know.
Yeah.
But like I say, not just improvisation, these guys giving their heart and soul and really helping make that scene was quite exceptional. So yeah, just like Joe says, you don't really realise what sound is doing to you in the cinema or as an actor, I suppose. Mm. And in that scene, it was really useful.
The gunshots you didn't hear, did you? But the singer. And actually, you know, often we use music whilst we're filming to evoke an atmosphere. And those guys singing that day really were the main ingredient to creating that atmosphere. And we had them singing kind of all day. I often, during rehearsals, I'd get them to sing out so people understood the atmosphere of what we were trying to create.
What was the particular song they were singing that you chose?
It was called... Oh, I've forgotten what the hymn's called. That's terrible.
I never knew what it was called, I don't think. It's good, wasn't it?
That was
Love
good,
it. Just a sneak peek there.
That was like a preview.
Yeah.
That was like a taster of what you can expect to experience when you go and see the movie.
The sound quality is a little bit better than that, isn't it? Yeah.
And singing might be a little bit better.
A little bit.
Yeah.
Well, just different because it's a chorus.
It's a chorus.
And this is a duet. And just one other question about that scene. In the film, so much of fate and chance or whatever you want to call it turns out badly for people. In filming that scene on the beach, was there anything that happened by fate or chance that actually turned out well?
Everything. The whole thing was an enormous leap of faith, and a leap of faith taken by over 1,000 people at once. And we were incredibly lucky. I mean, we only had a day to film it in, and so if the weather had been bad, if the wind had blown too strongly, if the film had trapped in the mag, there were a million things that could have gone wrong. I actually pushed Danny Mays off a wall the night before.
Yeah, you did, didn't
Not
you?
The night before, the Friday night before we shot the scene on Monday. We'd all been drinking somewhat. And
to take the edge off the tension.
To take the edge off the tension. Exactly that. And I ran at Danny, who was standing on a wall. Danny plays nettles.
Quite a large, tall wall. It was a 4
I didn't realise it was the drop the other side.
It was like a 12-foot drop on the other side.
And so if you're a stickler for continuity, you might notice that prior to that scene, Nettles is limping on his left foot. And during that scene, he's limping on his right foot.
Yeah,
so
is.
That could have gone horribly wrong. He could have actually
broke his leg. Yeah,
which I would have felt really bad about.
And I have a kind of a nitpicky question. Celia and Robbie both smoke in this film. And the way they smoke is so beautifully evocative. It's exactly like people smoked in films in the 30s and the 40s. Did you watch old films and practice wafting smoke just
beautifully? Well, as a smoker, I've recently given up, but then I had a couple last night of yours.
You did.
As a smoker, I think you quite often pretend that you're in an old movie and waft the smoke and do all that, and you play with ways that you smoke until you find your way. And as an actor, you definitely do that, and a bit of period smoking is always well nice, in my opinion. The thing that I love most is the fact that there's no filters, and you quite often get a little bit of tobacco on your tongue, and you get to just take it off or spit it out. And that's just, for me, you know, I'm not saying smoking's at all good and sexy, because I've stopped because I know it's bad and you smell and all that and your hangovers are much worse, but sometimes it just is.
But there, you know, it's a generation where smoking was glamorous. My father, who was in his 30s, 20s and 30s during the 1930s,
mm-hmm.
would never have his picture taken without a cigarette.
Really?
Because it was so glamorous that when you had your photograph taken, you had to have a cigarette in your hand. And also it kind of adds to the light, you know, it does lovely things to the lights.
How much of a metaphor do you want audiences to see in this film about class and preconceived notions and the legal system?
I think it's implicit in the movie. It's not a story about class, but class is part of the story, and I resent what the Tallis family do to Robbie, James's character, and that is partly about class. When it comes to it, he's not one of them, and so they can close ranks and turn their backs on him. And he's only there by their grace. He only has a future by their grace. Personally, I try very hard to get over my resentment of the more privileged classes. I try hard to get over my resentment that money buys you a better education in Britain. So it's a tangly web, really, and it is implicit in the story. And it was very important that Robbie was played by an actor who had an understanding of what it's like to be considered a second-class citizen. Is that fair enough to say?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's fair.
Do you count yourself working class?
No. I count myself as having comfy working class family. Right, yeah. I live my life in an incredibly middle class. I'm an actor and you're a jet set director. Right. We come from working class backgrounds, but I think what was important was that the actor came from a working class background, but also has an understanding of what it's like to live in a strange no man's land. Robbie inhabits a social territory that doesn't exist yet, and it makes people around him uncomfortable. In his own class, I think probably in his own class, but I think definitely in the classes above him as well. And I think it was useful to have an actor who knew what it was like to come from one background, but spend their life in an environment that not many people get allowed into. Actually, the environment that I live in is one that people of all classes don't always get allowed into, you know what I mean?
As we sit here at the Ritz and and
Yeah,
couldn't find
exactly,
coffee.
exactly. But yeah, I do think it was important that he was working class. The way that I always think about it is that, yeah, it is about class in a way, but it's not as well, because it's about, film's about stories, and one story that Robbie has told his entire life is that class will not keep you back. And then one day a 12-year-old girl comes along and says, by the way, the world's not the way you thought it was. This is the way the world is. They're all going to believe me now, and you have to go away. And then this government tell him who he is. They tell him he's a soldier. Tell him he's a criminal. And then the Germans tell him who he is. They tell him that he's going to die. There's only one person in the world who actually knows who he is. And if it wasn't for her, I think he'd kill himself. Because without her, I don't think he'd be able to recognize himself anymore.
Well, just the whole idea of the other. You can make a metaphor for immigration, you can make a metaphor for different religions or anything like that. I think that's part of why the story is so powerful.
Absolutely. But I think the best stories, or certainly my favorite stories, are stories about outsiders or about the other. And I think, without sounding too much like a wanker, that's a metaphor for the human condition. You know, I think we all feel like we're somehow other, and stories help us to connect to the world around us by expressing that feeling of otherness.
I have one, it's really not a serious question, but I noticed in Pride and Prejudice there was this really large pig. And I noticed in Atonement, for no readily apparent
It's the
reason,
same pig.
What? I
Yeah.
didn't know this.
You know, the pig in the yard
Yeah.
when Bryony goes to see Cecilia,
Yeah.
right? It's the same pig. It's called Paul, named after our producer, Paul Webster, which is a weird name for it because it's a girl. And that's not, it's a boy. And it's enormous.
Is this your personal pet pig?
No, I'd love it to be, but I'm afraid my house isn't big enough to keep a pig.
Will this be like Hitchcock appearing in every
Yeah,
film?
the pig is me. In fact, I am the pig in a pig suit. There are many, many little hidden moments in the movie that even some of my closest collaborators aren't aware of. There are also a lot of references to swallows are there to be found if you're inclined, which is a reference to the house where Christopher and I went and worked on the script together, and there's the house of some friends of mine in Tuscany in Italy, and there are a lot of swallows there. And so, as a little nod, wink to the lady of that house, there's swallows on Bryony's dress, and the tea room is called the Swallow Tea Room. And yeah, there's lots of little swallows scattered throughout the film.
There are many, many reasons to see this film more than once, and I say Swallows is as good as any.
And the pig.
And the pig!
Paul the pig.
Joe Wright, James McAvoy, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank
Thank you.
you.